For the week of March 8th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 271, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, lined up for my Apple Watch, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, that is going on right now, isn't it? There's like a big press conference for some Apple event is happening in Northern California, right?
That's right.
And you're not there, obviously, because we're talking right now.
Exactly.
But you are in line to actually purchase the watch.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is. I heard the gold one is going to cost like $15,000, the gold version.
Well, it's not time for me to buy that. But of course, with daylight savings and all that, you know, I need a new watch.
Because you're late for everything.
That's right. So, but I'm not late for the show. What will we be talking about this week?
Well, you actually don't need a watch for our show because you're probably listening to this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox a few hours or days or weeks or even months after it was recorded. Now, putting aside the fact that you can't listen to this show live, time-shifting content consumption has grown astronomically over the past several years thanks to technology like streaming and the DVR. TV execs, TV executives, as they're called in, you know, English, I suppose, they say they should get paid for all those viewers, even if some of them maybe kind of do skip the actual commercials. But ad execs, on the other hand, are saying, no. Now, we know the Academy Awards are over for this year, but it's never too early to start talking about next year's Oscar race. And I know you love hearing about that, Michael.
Absolutely.
With the Academy's Board of Governors meeting later this month, there are reports they may decide to revert back to having only 5 Best Picture nominees rather than the potential of 10, which is what it is now. Why would they do this? Is it a good idea, a bad idea? We'll discuss and find out. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about box office around the world, not just North America. We get our information from RentTrak. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times. Anywhere we find out information about worldwide box office. And the number one movie around the world stars movie star Will Smith, and it's called Focus. It made another $27 million, and it's at $71 million worldwide.
So Chappie, which is the number two movie around the world, could not beat it, but it missed out barely.
Yeah, just a couple $100,000. Well, when you're looking at worldwide box office, of course, it just depends what territories they're in. And these two movies are in about the same number of territories. Focus is in 50 territories, and Chappie is in 54 territories. It grossed $27 million around the world, just underneath Focus. In North America, it was the number one movie, opening very soft. This has to be, speaking of television and ads, this has to have the worst ad campaign I have seen in a long time. I mean, I can't believe it. This movie, Chappie, I saw an ad for this. I saw a bunch of ads. And I thought it was like some kiddie film. I thought it was like a low-rent version of Short Circuit, if that's even possible. But well, in fact, it's an R-rated action film. It's R-rated. I couldn't believe it when I saw that.
Well, you know, it stars Dev Patel.
It does start at Patel, but did you see the ads for this movie? Didn't you think this was for kids? When you look at the poster, it shows Chappie with little building blocks like kids have for spelling out words. That's how they spell the name Chappie. Again, that says children's film.
Yeah, I did think it was a children's film when I saw the trailer and the poster.
Yeah, it's R-rated. It should have been a soft PG, according to the ads, but it's an R. I mean, just incompetent, to say the least. And it opened up pretty softly, and we imagine, given the horrible reviews, it will fall hard. But it does star Dev Patel. He's in a lead role. He's from Slumdog Millionaires, of course. That's where a lot of people first knew him. And he has 2 movies this week.
That's Chappie, right. It's Dev Patel versus Dev Patel at the box office.
That's right. And Chappie is not doing so well, but his other film is the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, and that did quite well. It made $14 million over the weekend worldwide. It hit $30 million in counting. My mom saw it. She liked it. Said it wasn't as good as the first, but it was good and a little more serious. She was a little surprised by that. Not as funny as the first. There's a little more death in this one, but she enjoyed it. And if there's a third best exotic Marigold Hotel, by God, I'm sure she'll be there opening weekend.
Well, it came in 9th at the
Worldwide.
And I know here in the U.S., the big talk was about how, you know, most Hollywood studios kind of overlook senior citizens. And in this case, the senior citizens came out in droves for this particular movie. Second
well,
best
they define senior citizen as anyone who's 50 or older. So, you know, they're like, if you're not an 18-year-old boy, the joke is that Hollywood ignores you. I think that's sort of outdated.
I thought it was 35 or older.
Yeah, I think that thinking's a little outdated. They realize that you got to make movies for all age groups, all quadrants. Not every movie should appeal to every single group. And of course, this audience isn't flocking to opening weekend, which means when it made what it made around the world, which is $14 million, that's a sign that there's probably going to be really good legs for this flick. You know, they don't, I mean, more people came out for this on opening weekend than ever saw the first one.
That's true, yeah.
The chances are that it will probably hold well and that a lot of people didn't show up on opening weekend because that's not what older people do. They've got lives. You know, they're not 17-year-old kids who are buying their tickets in advance to the next Transformers. So it opened up to 14 million. People already said, oh, probably won't match the first. Well, probably won't, but I bet it has good legs. At number three around the world is Jupiter Ascending, the Wachowski sibling film, which has been a disaster around the world. They didn't get redemption, but they did get a little good news from China.
Yes.
It made $26 million over the weekend. It's at $150 million and counting. It's certainly not going to bring the movie into the black, but at least it was popular somewhere.
You know, speaking of popular, number four, Kingsman. Wow. $250 million total so far.
That's right. It's doing quite well. It cost about $80 million to make, so it's tripled its budget. It made $25 million over the weekend. The only mystery, they haven't announced a sequel yet. That movie is having good legs, whereas 50 Shades of Grey, which made $23 million over the weekend, is playing more like a horror film. It opened big, and it's fallen hard ever since. Doesn't mean the people aren't satisfied. Doesn't mean they won't show up for the two sequels. God willing, they won't make it three sequels and turn the final book into two movies. I don't think I can handle that.
Well, but then hey, it would be four sequels. Oh, three sequels. I get it. Four movies, three sequels. I understand. Yes, you're right.
Because it's a trilogy, right?
Yes.
It's a trilogy of books, yeah. So it's at $527 million and counting. Don't feel sorry for it. Big Hero 6 is right below that. That made $19 million, also benefiting from China. And that is solidly into the $600 million range. This is the highest second, I should say, the second highest grossing Disney animation film of all time. That means we're not talking about Pixar. We're talking about Disney. The Lion King is number one, and Big Hero 6 is number two, which is a good time to mention, Sperling, what?
Adjusted for inflation? Question
Thank
mark.
You very much, because yes. Big Hero 6 isn't remotely the highest grossing Disney animated film of all time. If you adjust for inflation, it'd be way down on the list. But, you know, there's a much bigger worldwide market now. That helps it, too. But, yeah, this is a solid success for the studio. I don't know if they'll make a sequel, but, you know, at least it's respectably in the black.
My question is, if they make a sequel, would they have to name it or title it Big Hero 6 2, or would they just name it Big Hero 7?
It would be Big Hero 6.1, right?
Ooh, love that. Yes, I'm calling. Hold on. I'm getting Bob Iger on the phone.
At number seven is Best Picture nominee American Sniper, which made another $19 million. It passed the $500 million mark worldwide. It is the highest grossing film released in North America in 2014, which means if you're released in January or December, it doesn't matter. They just add up the total amount you made, not in the calendar year, but of all the films released in 2014, American Sniper is number one. The biggest hit of the year in North America is Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, 70 years into his career.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest hit of 2014 was directed by an 80-year-old.
That's awesome. And number eight is SpongeBob SquarePants, Sponge Out of Water, another $16 million. It's chugging along. I thought it would be a little bit bigger, actually, but it's at $260 million worldwide. It's made money. Everyone is happy. And then we go all the way down, I think, to number 12 is the next film we're talking about. That's the Vince Vaughn film, Unfinished Business. It opened in North America, if you can say that. It grossed $4.8 million in North America alone, $7 million worldwide. It's just a flop. Beyond, I mean, people are talking about Will Smith and debating because of one film. What does that say about Vince Vaughn, whether he's still a movie star?
Well, I guess some people would argue, was he ever a movie star? Did he ever make a movie that, you know, went on to make $1 billion?
Is that your definition? Then there's only 14 people who are movie stars.
There you go.
Yeah. No, he's a star. He drew people to movies. They had big success on TV, and he's not done yet, but he's had like five flops in a row. And it's not just that they're doing poorly at the box office. They're also terrible movies. You know, that's the problem. Sometimes you make a good movie and it doesn't work. Sometimes you make a bad movie and it's commercially successful. The worst is when you're making junk and nobody wants to see it. Then you're in trouble. And he's in trouble, but thank God for True Detective. He'll be on HBO, and maybe HBO's True Detective will be the new reclaiming project. You know, Matthew McConaughey jumps up to an Oscar win platforming off of HBO. Maybe Vince Vaughn can have a career resurgence. I knew he should go into television, but I thought he should be one of the late night talk show hosts.
Oh,
he
that would actually
so
be great.
Good. When he replaced David Letterman while Letterman was out after his heart surgery, all those slots were open. Vince Vaughn should have changed careers.
Oh, that's true. Well, now, of course, we're going to talk a little bit later on. He might have his chance if he's at all politically minded.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe he would work there. So in limited release in North America, one other film worth talking about is Grey Gardens, which is the classic documentary film by the Maisels. It opened at Film Forum. It grossed $12,000. It was sadly appropriate timing, of course, and we'll get back to that later during our obituaries where we talk about Albert Maisels.
Yes, and it's Maisels.
Maisels, thank you very much. I loved this. There was a story about Amy Pascal in the trades, and you thought it was a spoof. You thought it was an Onion headline, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I just looked at it and went, okay, seriously? I mean, they're trying to get back at Seth Rogen because he made this movie, The Interview, and you know, is that really how you're going to get back at him? By, like, saying that
what was the story?
The story was that Amy Pascal, who is now no longer the head of Sony because Tom Rothman... She was supposed to stick around until like the summer until they found somebody. Well, they found somebody the following week. So she said, great, I'm moving. I'm done. I was going to stick around. Tom Rothman used to run a studio. He doesn't need to be shown the ropes. He knows the ropes. I'm gone. I'm going to go start my producing deal over on the lot. I'm going
to
take.
You make it sound like it's all her choice. She was done. They wanted her to move away.
Right.
There's nothing for her to do when the new boss has been hired.
Right. And so she was moving off to her production deal. She was going to take over Seth Rogen's offices on the studio lot there at Sony in Culver City.
Except Seth Rogen had the most desirable office on the lot. It was the one she really wanted.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't just random, like, oh, okay, he's moving out. I'll take them. She'd had her eye on these offices for ages.
Right. That's right. And there was one problem was that it smelled a lot like marijuana smoke. Like he'd smoked too much marijuana in the actual office, so she had to have it fumigated before she moved in. And I thought that was kind of funny because, you know, most people would think, oh my gosh, that's like a knock on Seth Rogen. And Seth Rogen's like, that's right.
But I mean, this, and then the story was filled with people talking about, oh yeah, you couldn't walk by the office. People on other floors were complaining about the smell of the smoke. I mean, it sounds like they were constantly lighting up.
Well, did you read the interview with his Rolling Stone interview?
I did not.
And that's exactly what they talked about, that like he was, you know, constantly smoking marijuana along with everybody else that, you know, worked with him.
Now we understand his film.
Yes. We don't find it nearly as funny, however.
I like some of his movies.
No, that was a joke because, you know, with the... You get the giggles.
Keep going.
All right. Well, you know, certainly last year at the end
so
of
I thought you made that joke that you thought it was an Onion headline. That was the funniest joke I saw on Twitter. Is that I saw this joke about Amy Pascal can't move into Seth Rogen's office because it smells so much like pot. And they thought, oh, that's got to be an Onion headline. It can't be true.
No, that's actually a good joke. I can't take credit for it.
Okay.
I wish I could because
can you take credit for the Oscars?
I always take credit for the Oscars. I tell every year, I have a little forum in January. I invite all of the filmmakers over to my house. We have, whatever trendy.
Gene cookies.
Yeah, this year it was kale, something kale, anything having to do with kale and quinoa. And I tell them what movies to make if they want to win Oscars. And this year I said, Ava, I think it's the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma next year. You should make this movie Selma. Go do all that. Right. Find somebody who can play Martin Luther King.
You are the only person who wants to take credit for the Oscars because nobody else does.
That's
Neil
true.
Patrick Harris, he's gone. Craig Zaden and Neil Moran, the producers, they're gone. The Academy Board, they're furious. They're furious over their own show and their own awards. They're blaming everybody but themselves. Everybody's unhappy with the Oscars.
Well, so it's true. He said he's unlikely to do the show again, or did he just say, I'm not going to do it? And Neil Patrick Harris, he's done. He's like,
He's like, I haven't been asked, but it's exhausting. I really, you know, I can't see doing it again right away, even if asked, not that anyone has. And it made it sound like he didn't have a good time at all.
He didn't look like he was having a good time, and that was part of the problem.
Well, I mean, post-show and the whole experience, because he kept saying things like, he was very polite and suave about it, but he's like, well, you know, I understand people want to comment, but, you know, a lot of work goes into it. Like, yeah, whatever. We know, you know, it's not, every joke is, you know, analyzed to the nth degree and nothing was done, you know, haphazardly. And we worked really hard. It's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he understands why people comment, but it's still not nice.
You know, and that was part of the problem. It was so stilted and so stuffy and so... it just was too tightly wound. And whereas, like, the Billy Crystal, one of his best moments came when there was a gentleman who starred in silent movies accepting some applause and a special award in the aisle at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, or maybe it was down at the Shrine. And they gave him a microphone, which wasn't turned on. And so he's, like, thanking everybody, and the camera's on him, and it's just, like, his lips are moving, nobody can hear him. And Billy Crystal, like, said, well, it's kind of appropriate. He did star in silent movies. Well, and I thought, that was very good. He thought on his feet. It was one of the funniest jokes of that particular Oscar ceremony.
Well, the problem of the Oscars was not Neil Patrick Harris as the host. It wasn't even the producer. It was the whole shebang. I mean, the producers have done three in a row. Craig Zaden and Neil Maron, very successful theater and film producers and television. They had three hosts in a row, Seth MacFarlane, Ellen DeGeneres, which was the highest rated Oscars in 10 years. So you can't say, oh, they've been a disaster. And then Neil Patrick Harris. And now they were like, oh, we're stepping away. We're very tired. And I felt like everybody just wanted to get out before the boat sank, and they wanted to leave before they were asked to leave. That was the vibe I got from everybody involved in this year's Oscars. And now the Academy is weighing in. And what have they decided? They've had a brilliant idea. The ratings are down. They don't know what to do. So what are they going to do, Sperling?
You know what would be better is if there are fewer movies nominated. That way, fewer people will show up. You know, fewer potential movie stars will show up. And then, you know, fewer people might actually have a chance to see.
And ratings will soar.
When they kind of increased the number of movies that could be nominated for Best Picture, I thought, okay, that's actually fair. There are more movies being made now.
Well, no, not compared to the 30s and 40s.
Correct. Yes, that's true.
But there is a surge of indie films. So probably, you know, compared to 20, 30 years ago, there are probably more movies getting commercial releases, substantial.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, that's good. Because remember, the Academy Awards were really founded and started to actually promote movie going and to promote the movies. So that's what this is meant to do. So if you're going to honor five, then you're only promoting those five. Why not honor up to 10?
Right. So they say that the board is furious. This was according to the Hollywood Reporter. They hated the length of the show. They hated the quality of the show. They're unhappy with declining ratings, even though 1 year earlier they had a 10-year high. And they're angry that the Best Picture nominees are just art house fare. And that's seen red. And they're very angry. And so they're like, well, we're going to dump it. We're going to go back to five. They're thinking about it. And one comment was they did it to add and boost TV ratings. And I'm like, was that the only reason they added nominees? Because if that was the only reason, and it certainly was a key one, but it would be dumb. I mean, I thought they realized there were more than five films available every year to nominate for Best Picture. And for 20 years or so, the Academy did nominate 8 or 10 movies a year back in the 30s and the 40s. So you were sort of returning to something that had been done in the early days. And, you know, every critic in the country says, here are the 10 best films of the year. Why shouldn't the Oscars?
Well, it came the year where Dark Knight, which everybody thought...
The year after.
Everybody thought The Dark Knight should have been nominated for Best Picture, and it wasn't. And everybody thought, well, if there were more nominations, more slots, it would have made the cut. Yes.
Well, that's my question for you. First of all, let's look at the list of 8 movies that were nominated this year. I don't like most of them. They're not on my best of the year list. But as far as the Oscars are concerned, which of these films shouldn't have been nominated for Best Picture? And they all won an Oscar of some sort. There's American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. I want to know those 8 films, which 3 bring shame to the Oscars and make you angry that you watched? Which ones should be cut?
Not a single one of them.
Right. I mean, Selma only won Best Song, and American Sniper won Sound Editing. American Sniper is the highest grossing film of the year, and Selma is, an acclaimed film. They'd look like idiots if it hadn't gotten any nomination whatsoever. Birdman won the whole thing. Boyhood was one of the most acclaimed. Imitation Game was one of the biggest indie hit of the year by some lights. Whiplash got a lot of great press and attention and won some big key awards. Grand Budapest Hotel is an Oscar favorite, returning yet again. I mean, you know, The Theory of Everything won Best Actor. What of these movies? And if you eliminate them, are ratings going to go back up again? If you got rid of, you know, I don't even know what you'd get rid of. The Imitation Game and Selma and Sniper. Do you think that's going to boost ratings?
No. And what I would like to do is pause for a moment and say that, and I'm going to pause on the ratings issue for a moment. Okay. And say that what I like about the fact that films like Whiplash or Selma get nominated, and yeah, they may not have a really good shot at winning Best Picture, okay? But what I like about that is that Whiplash, a small movie that has, it's done fairly well.
Oh, yeah.
And Selma, these are, you know, low-budget movies that don't make a lot of money at the box office, but by being nominated for a Best Picture, it's kind of getting an honorable mention ribbon. And for these filmmakers, for Ava DuVernay, of Selma, and oh my gosh, I'm completely blanking on the director of Whiplash. It'll come to me in a moment, but it helps their careers. And these are obviously talented filmmakers who will have an easier time now moving on to make another film because their film, whether it was their first, second, it doesn't matter what number of films they have behind them. They will actually have an easier time making another movie and raising money for another movie because their film was nominated for Best Picture.
So the Oscars would be celebrating and shining a spotlight on filmmakers like Damien Chazelle.
Thank
and
you. Help- yes.
I didn't want to rescue you too soon. And helping them, you know, shining a spotlight on quality films.
Yes.
Should Guardians of the Galaxy and Dark Knight and some big movies be in there? Yes. Historically, have the Oscars often included some of the biggest hits of the year and they actually had chances to win? Absolutely. You know, that happened a lot. And there is a bit of a veering away from commercial success, though arguably there are fewer really good commercial films that are worthy of being nominated. There's one or two, but, you know, I mean, it used to be more often that there was more of a convergence between decent and commercially successful.
Well, and but, when pretty much you have... you're kind of bifurcating the business where you have, you know, Terminator 20 or Transformers 400 or whatever they're up to mm-hmm. these days on one side, nothing in the middle, and then independent fare on the other side. Well, you pretty much know that whatever the last Transformers movie is probably not going to be nominated. Okay, so then that leaves you with, instead of superhero movies, pretty much. You know, the independent fare.
But like films like Spider-Man 2 and Guardians of the Galaxy, they are critically acclaimed. The Dark Knight, one of the most
Spider-Man
2
was critically acclaimed? Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 1 and 2. The original, Tobey Maguire. Not the Andrew Garfield. Good God. I took that for granted. You know, Dark Knight, Guardians of the Galaxy. These are quality films. Not all of them would be on my list of the best of the year, but they deserve to be in the mix and they should have been in the mix. But my question is, you said, hey, if they had expanded the nominations, films like Guardians or Dark Knight probably would have made the cut. But do they know that? I assume that the details and the totals of who wins what and what was nominated are kept under lock and key. They don't burn them, do they? And didn't the board go to their accountants and say, look, we want to know, last 20 years, if we'd expanded it to 10 films, what movies would have made the cut? What would they have been? Didn't they do that to see what would be on the list?
I think there was some question about whether that occurred or not. And I think they may have done that.
If they didn't,
privately.
They're idiots.
Well, as you say, one would hope they kept that and that the accounting firm kind of has that information and that they use that information to expand the list. And a lot of people felt they must have done that the year after Dark Knight wasn't nominated to go, you know, if we expanded this, it would have been like the sixth movie nominated.
Right. You know, it'd be very easy to make the top list better if they sort of had some feeding system from other categories like animated, documentary, foreign films. You know, the Grammys use panels to make sure that the Grammy Awards were looking ridiculous for a while. It was all like Celine Dion and middle-aged music. And there was no sense of all the current good music that was being made, being represented in Album of the Year. So they created some panels and some groups to make sure that they narrowed down the list and got on a short list stuff that actually reflected the best and most popular music of the year. The Oscars, you know, maybe it's a scandal to suggest it, but they should do something like that. It's not like the top voted documentary film should automatically get on the list, but I'm sorry, animated films should be on the list. Documentary films should be on the list. More foreign films should be on the list. Blockbusters should be on the list. And if they need to set up some sort of panel and look at what the Grammys did to make sure that the actual final list isn't just all small, tiny little films, that's, you know, look what other people are doing. And it's worked for the Grammys. The Grammy Awards are a little bit more relevant. They don't embarrass themselves every year by ignoring the hippest, hottest albums of the year.
And I can tell you that many of the people I spoke with after the Academy Awards, and everybody knowing that I work in the entertainment industry, friends and family would come up and say, "What do you think of the Academy Awards? What do you?" And then without even like waiting for me to respond, "I hated it." You know, like they would, but the big complaint was, you know, none of the big stars were there. Where was George Clooney? Where was, you know, insert name of big star that they were hoping to see, many of whom have become the kind of awards ceremony staples that people like to see.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, first of all, George Clooney didn't have a movie. Where was Angelina?
Stop Jack Nicholson from sitting in the front row for 30 years in a row, though, did it?
No, and that's why. That's why you keep seeing Taylor Swift sitting in the front row of the Grammys. Granted, right, she was nominated this year, but still, there's a reason they keep cutting back to shots of her chair dancing, because that's what people want to see.
Yeah, George Clooney should have been there. Does he have to be there every year? He should be as much as possible, I guess, right?
I said there's usually two reasons why somebody is not there, or a couple reasons, but the two leading reasons are A, they're working,
yeah,
or B, they're not working, and there's a reason they're not working because they're not all that popular anymore. So they probably shouldn't be sitting in the front row.
Well, you know, this wouldn't boost ratings. It would not make the Oscars more relevant. It wouldn't help the bigger long-term problem that they have of making sure their top nominees reflect, you know, the zeitgeist. But one thing they should do is release voting totals. I know they can't do it for this year, but they could at least say 75 years ago this year and release those voting totals. Everybody's dead who was involved in the Oscars 75 years ago.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, because there's a reason they don't do it now. Like, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, it's just tradition. And they want to say, oh, there's a winner and not make it a horse race and how close was it. But it's fun. And 75 years ago, you know, everybody's dead. So it would just be fun. And if you started next year and said and released just on the screen, you know, imagine if they showed the voting totals for 1941, which would be 75 years ago. That was the year How Green Was My Valley beat out Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon, Sergeant York, and The Little Foxes, among others, to win Best Picture. You know, Orson Welles famously got all these nominations and only won for, I think, Best Screenplay, right?
Yes.
Who wouldn't want to know how much Gary Cooper beat out Orson Welles and Cary Grant by? Who wouldn't want to know how much John Ford beat out Orson Welles and Howard Hawks by? Who wouldn't want to know how much How Green Was My Valley won by? It would be awesome. You could hear, I could imagine the people in this theater going, woo, you know, when they saw how close it was or how far away it was. I mean, it would be fun. It wouldn't really help, but it would be cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And especially 1940. That was a banner year along with 1939. But 1941, specifically the Academy Awards that year were, I mean, as you say, look at all those legends.
Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Charles Foster Kane. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. No, you couldn't go wrong. Not every year would be exciting, but there'd always be one of the big races between acting and directing and film that would be fun.
I wonder if they have those records. If they did,
They have the records.
It would definitely be. It would be big.
It would be fun.
Yeah.
It would be big. Yes.
Okay. Yes. It is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Hey, you know what? If Bruce Willis can defend or defeat terrorists, he can surely handle the New York Times theater critic, right? Although maybe not the theater critic from Birdman, because she was just vicious. He better hope so, as the film star plans to make his Broadway debut in an adaptation of the Stephen King novel Misery. Willis, of course, will play the famous writer, while Elizabeth Marvel, a stage veteran and star of House of Cards, will play the Kathy Bates role as superfan Annie Wilkes. Annie is miffed, to say the least, when Wilkes finds out her favorite author is planning to kill one of her favorite characters. Willis was last around the New York theater scene way back in 1983 when he understudied for Ed Harris in a production of Fool for Love. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. It's, you know, this was workshopped like a couple years ago, three, 4 years ago, I think in LA or somewhere else. I guess it makes sense as a theater production. It didn't get great reviews. William Goldman adapted it, just like he adapted the novel for the Oscar-winning film. It's sort of set in one location, so it makes sense as a stage play. It's like a two-hander, you know. We know she's going to break his legs or whatever the hell she does, I forget, during the movie. But I don't know. It just seems, you know, I wasn't a big fan of the movie. It's going to be scenery chewing for two actors. Maybe they'll have fun. It'll be fun to see Bruce Willis on stage, but it's certainly not something that sounds like it's going to be actually, you know, good.
Well, now, speaking of things that might not actually be good, have you seen the new Larry David show? The play opened this week at the Court Theater, right?
Well, yeah. Why do you say it's not good?
I've read two really bad reviews of it.
Oh, yeah. I saw it. It was dreadful.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no, it was. I didn't have to review it. A friend of mine took me, and it's you know, they would have been better off just taking three episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm and mounting them on the stage. Have a little break between each, 5-minute break. I mean, all people wanted was to see Curb Your Enthusiasm live. He just did this lazy, tepid. It's like the three most boring episodes of Curb done on stage. All the actors are fine, but it's just so lazy, you know, jokes about toilet flushing, you know, the sexy Latina maid has had a child. Oh, my gosh. You know, the dead father fathered a child with his maid. Oh, what a thing. I can't imagine. It just feels so retro, you know, in a bad way. And
so what you're
lazy.
Saying is a show about nothing might work on TV when it's a half an hour long and there are commercials in between, but it doesn't really work on stage.
No, it's not a show about nothing. The dad dies. The sons fight over who has to take in the mother. And the maid says, by the way, your father fathered my child and you need to help support him. So a lot happens. It's just not funny at all.
You know what I saw last week was a very old play. Not very old, but it's an older play. It's a remounting of The Price, the Arthur Miller play. I saw it at the Mark Taper Forum at the Music Center here in Los Angeles. And boy, that Arthur Miller, he sure could write. I mean, you just listen to the dialogue and the story and the cat. I mean, just wow. Okay, now you kind of, when you see it performed live in front of you, you can really grasp by what made him talented.
Well, you know, The Price is not often considered one of his best. It's sort of towards the end. Well, not the end. I mean, but 68.
Yes,
was when,
very
when
good. That's very quick of you. Yes.
Yeah. It's not considered one of his big ones. You know, the big. Three or four, obviously. The Crucible, Death of a Salesman, All My Sons, and A View from the Bridge. You know, that's more than almost anybody could hope for. Those are pretty big shows. So, but The Price you liked. It was a good production?
It was a solid production. It was I don't want to say mediocre, but it was above average. It wasn't great, but what I liked about it was merely the writing is so well done and it's perfect. It's like you can actually see somebody who knows narrative, who knows how to spin characters and develop characters. It's you know, in that regard, it was good. The acting and the actual production was okay.
Yeah. Well, those are some really obviously landmark works, but the greatest American playwright of all time?
Shakespeare.
American? The greatest American playwright of all time?
That was the joke.
Oh.
When I said Shakespeare,
August Wilson.
Oh, okay.
You got Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill, Arthur Miller, Edward Albee. They've all got like two or three really great plays. August Wilson has like seven.
What about Noel Coward?
Not American, but certainly he's not even close.
Oh, that's true.
He has a couple of nice light shows, but he's not an important playwright.
Neil Simon?
Right. Yeah, he has a couple really good shows, but nowhere near.
Okay. Well, you know who is important these days is China. Actually, China. An entire country. Yeah. They are invading New York City, in fact, Michael. You might want to take cover. Well, no, not really. But it may feel like that because for the annual Book Expo of America, the largest gathering in the publishing industry every year, China is sending a delegation. And this is a small delegation, okay? So let's not get too excited. They're sending 500 people.
That is so many people.
Which is,
I don't know if anybody sends 500 people to Book Expo.
Well, they didn't want to, you know, slight them, but they only had about 0.0000001% of their publishing industry that they could afford to send over. It's the largest foreign delegation to ever come to the BEA and may in fact be the largest single group, period, to make the trip. That's a lot of hotel rooms, in fact. And of course, that's a market with a lot of books to buy. Key Chinese publishers and government officials are among the attendees. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, China is not just about movies. We talk about them all the time in terms of their box office. they're a big country. They're buying lots of stuff, and they're going to become a big player in every area of the world if they're not already. And book publishing clearly is one area where they're going to grow. And with Kindles and eBooks and the ability to translate them and make them available quickly and easily, you know, that market could be huge in a pretty quick time.
Okay, is anybody awake over there at Comedy Central? That's one of the questions I want to know. I need an answer to that because I honestly believe that they may have fallen asleep on the job. Some of it's been bad luck, but they've now lost Jon Stewart from The Daily Show, Stephen Colbert from The Colbert Report, John Oliver, Jason Jones, and now Samantha Bee. Now, the latter three were from The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. Larry Wilmore already stepped up and he took over the post-Daily Show slot. Bee is headed to TBS, which is already in business with her and her husband, Jason Jones. They are overseeing a sitcom built around family vacations that Jones will star in, not the family vacations, the shows. Now, they're also doing a daily topical show that will skewer current events from a comedy perspective. I don't know. I don't know if that kind of stuff will work. In other words, they're doing their own daily show. Brett Weitz of Original Programming had this to say, and this is a quote: "We're thrilled to have Sam join Jason at TBS and really make this a family affair. We actually have their kids coming in next week to pitch us animation." End quote. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in a negative sense for Comedy Central. Good God. I mean,
you thought people were leaving the Academy Awards telecast.
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody has left. I mean, we thought, well, gee, maybe Jason Jones was told, no, you're absolutely not going to get it. So he jumped ship, but she's gone too. I mean, you know, I'm waiting for Asif Manvi and, you know, who's left? They're all going to be gone. There's going to be literally no one to take over the show. Nobody wants to follow Jon Stewart. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe, you know, they've all been, you know, he's been there for 16 years and it's sort of like, all right, everything's changing and everybody's, you know, looking at their lives and their priorities and seeing what opportunities are out there. And people have been trying to poach them for a long time, I'm sure. And suddenly everything came together. But boy, it's not good for Comedy Central.
No, because ideally you would have had Jon Stewart remain the host as you groomed a successor. And in this case, he's saying, no, I already said I'm leaving. So it's not like they could even get a new rash of talent in there and train him up for a few years. That's just not going to happen.
Well, for a few years, he's leaving in the fall.
That's what I mean. Yeah, you can't do it. So it's,
well, he's been grooming people for years, but they didn't lock him into place. And part of that was bad luck. I mean, he had Stephen Colbert, he had John Oliver, he had Larry Wilmore, he had Samantha Bee and Jason Jones. He groomed a lot of people. What's his name? Steve Carell. I mean, the show is the more fertile for talent than Saturday Night Live has been for, you know, 20 years. So he did that constantly, but they did not keep people in house. They let the talent get away. And that's the problem.
Well, and I think Asif Manvi actually could work. I mean, he's actually very, very good.
Yeah, sure. A lot of them could have worked, but, you know, not a good sign when you're being reduced to, you know, no choice. Yeah. You know, you wanted to hopefully have this big pool of talent and say, ooh, we're so lucky. Who should we choose? Right now you're like, Asif, can you please do the show?
Right. Who's behind the camera? Can you do the show? Yeah. So the trial over the hit song Blurred Lines is underway. You know that, Michael?
I do.
Yeah. Well, at issue, in part, is whether the song plagiarizes a song by Marvin Gaye. Artist Robin Thicke performed songs for the jury to demonstrate certain points and that it's all been fun, really. But here's why most of these cases never make it to court. Big companies, they hate to reveal financial details. In this case, it's the question of exactly how profitable the song Blurred Lines has been for all involved. Now, keep in mind that Blurred Lines has been a monster hit, once-in-a-career-type hit for Thicke. But also keep in mind that co-songwriter Pharrell Williams has had a pretty massive worldwide hit with Happy, just to name one other example. Of course, he did the Daft Punk Get Lucky tune as well, that track what he was contributed to. So the actual profits for Blurred Lines, not how much it grossed for everyone, has been detailed as about $16.5 million. About $5.6 million went to Thicke, $5 million to Williams, Pharrell Williams, $700,000 to co-songwriter T.I., and finally, the last $6 million went to the record label. Not many songs are that massive, of course, but still, it makes clear a solid hit can be, you know, it could bring in profits of $1 million, even in the age of depressed album sales. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's fun when they go to trial and we actually get to see numbers. You just go, ooh, $16 million. He got $6 million for one song. I mean, that's pretty cool. Normally, what movies make, how much they generate in all these areas, what albums make and songs and radio stuff, we just don't know. It's all a big mystery. So it's very cool when something goes to trial and we actually get some final figures. And speaking of trials, of course, I mean, I think you know the people involved. The trial over Midnight Rider, that was the independent film that was shooting, and a crew member was killed when a train came on some tracks that they were shooting on and didn't presumably have permission to be there. She died. Everybody sued. And that trial, suddenly today, everything has come to a head, hasn't it?
Yes, Randall Miller was the director of that film. Jody Savin was the his not only his wife, but the producer. There was one other producer that was charged, Jay Sedrish, I believe. And they were going to go to trial over this. They were charged.
They're in trial. They're in court.
Yeah, they were. They were in trial. They were jury selection was taking place today.
Yes.
But instead of going through with the trial, they said, OK, we're going to enter guilty pleas.
That's right. Miller pled guilty. He got 2 years in jail. 8 years on probation, a $25,000 fine, 360 hours of community service, and an agreement that he can't direct while he's under probation. So for the next 10 years, he's not going to be a director. Not that anyone's probably lining up to sign him up for a new movie anyway. In exchange, the charges against his wife were dropped, but executive producer Jay Sedrish, he also entered, it's called an Alford plea, which means you accept that there's a good case there and that the facts are against you, but you're not technically pleading guilty. I'm not sure what the difference is between an Alford plea and, say, what's the other thing that you do?
You plead guilty.
No. You plead guilty, not guilty. You also plead no contest or no whatever. I forget.
Yeah.
But anyway, he also entered a plea, and he got 10 years probation and a $10,000 fine.
Well, now, so, the Alford plea, I think probably most recently, was a famous recent example was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the West Memphis 3 entered an Alford plea.
Why would they have entered an Alford plea?
I think it was so that they couldn't go back and sue. Is a guilty plea in criminal court whereby
yeah, they were told you have to plead. They use the Alford plea so that you can not then come turn around and sue us.
Right.
I see. Yes. That's true.
Because you're admitting, you're saying, I'm going to plead guilty, but not admit that I actually committed the act.
No. That doesn't mean you get to assert your innocence while acknowledging that prosecutors have enough evidence to convict you. That's what an Alford plea means. You assert your innocence, but you acknowledge they got enough evidence to put you to jail or to find you guilty. So it's a difference between,
Yeah, it's a very sad case for all involved, I think, in the case of the Midnight Rider case. I mean,
well,
there's somebody who's died.
It's not sad in the sense that justice was served. The guy was, they were shooting on tracks where they shouldn't have been, and somebody died. It's ridiculous. No one should die making a movie, and it's not an accident where something went wrong. It's an accident where they shouldn't have been there in the first place, and they broke protocol on what you do, and they shouldn't have been there, and they were told they couldn't be there, and they were on train tracks, and a train came. What do you think is going to happen? So, no, it's not a sad day. It's a good day, because too often people get off and are, it was an accident, and he's just a director of a film. It's like, no, he should be held responsible.
Now, Netflix had so much fun winning Emmys, they've decided to go for this little thing that we were talking about earlier. It's a man's name, and I can't remember.
The Teddy, the Joey, the Oscar.
Yes, that one. They want that. They want one of those because they think it's shinier than the Emmy. I don't know. The streaming video website, is that what we should call Netflix these days? Maybe a content channel, a streaming service, video show and website, something like that. Well, whatever you call them, Netflix is gunning for the Oscar. They've just snagged worldwide theatrical rights to the indie war drama Beasts of No Nation, based on an acclaimed novel about child soldiers. It's directed by Cary Fukunaga of HBO's True Detective, and he also had a film at Sundance many years ago. It stars actor Idris Elba. The film cost $6 million to make, and Netflix bought it for $12 million. So that's a little nice profit there. Specifically with the intent, they bought it, of giving the film a year-end awards season push. Big deal or big whoop?
I thought, oh, gee, I wonder, you know, is that good? Can you do that for Oscar chances? But you can, because, you know, lots of documentaries and stuff get released. You just have to have a theatrical run. And in certain cases, you have to have your theatrical run at least at the same time or in advance of some digital release. So I'm sure they've looked at those rules. But my next thought was, how are they going to release it? If they want to maximize the potential for an Oscar and maximize the potential for profit, are they going to do a theatrical run and then a Netflix? And, you know, it wasn't clear at first, but no, it's all day and date. They're going to start streaming the same day that they put it in theaters. And all the big theater chains said, yeah, thank you, but no thank you. So there's clearly just an art house film project, you know, but that really has
what they're
to
going
hurt
your to Oscar. Do. What they're going to do is they're going to four wall a theater.
No, they're not going to four wall a theater. There's theater. There's independent art house chains that are happy to show it. They do all the time. IFC, Sundance, all these places are showing movies that are available online constantly. No, they're just going the art house route. And what's that one? This Alamo Steam Draft House.
Alamo Steam Draft.
Alamo Draft House. They've already said they'll take the film.
Alamo Steampunk. Steampunk Alamo.
That's like three screens. It's not a big deal. But no, those independent art house places, they don't care about this. They're fine with it. But the big chains aren't going to do it. And doesn't that really hurt your Oscar chances? If you could have made more money, you know, is Netflix, if they've got content, you know, maximizing the best thing for the content doesn't always
mean... they've done this in the past because they did do The Square last year.
Yes, and this very, very small independent documentary film, which is never going to make money. I mean, almost no documentary film makes more than $1 million. If you make $1 million, you are one of the highest grossing documentary films of all time.
Oh, so what you're saying is that they're now doing it with
this is a big
narrative.
High-profile movie. Okay. Why are they squandering it by day and dating it with streaming? It's going to screw up your Oscar chances because people will think less of it.
I can tell you why they're doing it.
And it's harder to get a bigger platform
because
in order to release it more, make more money, and get more attention. It's not the smartest way to release a film you think is Oscar worthy.
Well, they would never say that because they are a streaming service, and they have always said, and Ted Sarandos, who is their head of content over there, says, nope, there is no difference between a day and date release and a theatrical release. We are just as important as theatrical. And so if they said, no, we're going to cede to theatrical this time, then they are basically putting themselves down. So there's no way they're going
to
do that.
But they're not. To say that you can make more money by showing it having a window, there's nothing wrong with windows. Does Netflix think all windows are completely evil and that Avengers should obviously be streaming day and date? Then
yes.
They're idiots. They're idiots if that's what they think, that they could make more money by streaming in a home day and date when it's something like the Avengers Age of Ultron. If they think that's the smart way to release Avengers, then they're fools. If they think the smartest way to get attention for this movie is to day and date it streaming, I think they're wrong.
I haven't heard Ted Sarandos's comments on blockbuster day and date. But I'm going to actually do a little research and find out what he thinks.
Alrighty.
Now, David Letterman is getting out just in time. The late-night talk show host departs in May and is probably glad, frankly. During February sweeps, he barely held off Jimmy Kimmel and was substantially behind Jimmy Fallon, just like he trailed Jay Leno for many years. We disdain demos at Showbiz Sandbox, and you know that. Viewers are viewers. It doesn't matter. And total viewers, Fallon attracted about 3.8 million people a night versus Letterman's 2.8 million. And Kimmel at 2.7, why such a modest audience would translate into gazillions of dollars is a bit of a mystery, but it does. Conan, by the way, was up a bit and reaches about 800,000 people a night. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop. You know, he's been on for decades. It's no shame that, you know, he's fading off into the sunset and is not number one. You know, he hasn't been number one for a long time. He was actually almost never number one, right? He was number one briefly when he first went to CBS. Other than that, NBC's, you know, The Tonight Show was always number one. So there's, you know, he's leaving in a dignified way. It's a little shame. Somebody said Jimmy Fallon should be hosting the Oscars. They should sign him up for 3 years right away and just say he's going to be the host for the next 3 years. That's the way to get continuity. I'm like, all right. But, you know, that's the late night wars. Things don't change a lot. But, boy, there's a lot of change coming with Stephen Colbert. Do we still call him Colbert? And Jimmy Corden. That's going to be interesting to see. But in the morning wars, Good Morning America, still on a roll, crushing the Today Show. But they've both got more viewers than the late night. Good Morning America reaches 5.7 million people a week. And Today Show, 5.1. And if we're talking about TV ratings, the Fox hit Empire, the hip-hop drama. It grew for its eighth week in a row in the overnights.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is.
NBC is getting into the over-the-top game. joining numerous other content providers who love the idea of people paying them directly to access a platform bursting with content. In this case, NBC isn't repurposing its primetime lineup. They expect the very nascent idea for a service to feature comedy. And thus, NBC scores their first laughs since they haven't introduced a top 20 hit since, I don't know, Just Shoot Me back in 1997. Maybe this site will include complete episodes of The Tonight Show and SNL. Maybe it will include original content. Who knows? Not NBC, but they do know it'll cost about $3. Big deal or big whoop?
Why would you even talk about this? They have no idea of what they're doing. They're going to just do a comedy website when they haven't had hit comedies in decades. It's just ridiculous that they would even talk about this. And they're already like, we'll do other brands too, like Faith and Family over-the-top websites and horror websites. Yes, because NBC is so good at horror. I mean, it is NBC Universal. Hey, slice and dice your content all you want. That's a good idea, I guess. But like, $3 for a comedy website and then $3 for a Faith and Family. Do the people really think everyone's going to be signing up $3 here, $2 there, $5 there for all these TV channels? I mean, bundled cable looks better and better all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that, and this is what we're going to talk about in a moment, you know, over the top, all of these linear networks, linear television channels, be it on broadcast or cable, linear is the old black. Over the top is the new black. And after the Disney deal last year, where Disney and Dish cut a deal in which Dish could sell Disney content to non-subscribers, mm-hmm. and that's, I think they call it Dish Sling.
The dam burst.
Yeah, the dam burst. And now every network, every cable channel, they're all trying to figure out what's our over the top strategy. We have to have one.
That's right. But comedy, you've been weak in comedy for 20 years. Why would that be what you'd lead with? And why not NBC? Why not do NBC over the top? I guess they can't.
Yeah, because then you don't want to certainly...
But talk about something when you have no information on what it's going to include or what it's going to be or what it'll be like or what's going to... You know, what's the point?
We're going to do something at some time in the future, which will be about...
Something.
Yeah. Or we'll get Larry David to do it with Jerry Seinfeld and it'll be about nothing. We're not sure.
It's not easy to be a TV network executive these days. It probably was a lot easier in the 70s. You had two other rivals to look at.
That's right.
You know, you're at NBC. What's ABC doing? What's CBS doing? It's not that simple anymore, and that's why we should head on into Inside Baseball.
Yes, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're looking at a headline, TV Execs, advertisers in a 4-day war over audience count rules.
Let me sum this up in one sentence. TV networks say, pay us more money. Advertisers say, we don't want to.
Yes, that's pretty much it. Although I do think that headline reads as if there is a 4-day war about to occur, and then like on day 5, it's going to be over.
Yeah, like the 100 years war. It's the 4-day war.
Yeah, but...
But what is it a war over?
It's a war over the fact that people are shifting when they watch television. So, you know, most people watch it the day of, or used to watch it the day of.
Now, when it aired.
When it aired. But now people are pushing it back a day or two or 7. And what's happening is you're beginning to see that all of a sudden your audience can sometimes double after the 7th day or
That's
up to
right.
the 7th day.
That's right. So network executives say, hey, look at all the people watching our shows. This is why we've been talking for a while about needing a new TV rating system. All we hear reports on are the overnights. But in fact, if you wait 10 days, suddenly you find out the audience is much bigger than you've been telling about. You know, American Horror Story, The Walking Dead, any show you can talk about actually has much bigger audience than the numbers that get bandied about all the time. So a lot of things are happening. HBO and some cable channels are stopped reporting overnights because they want to make sure the bigger number of how many people watch their show is the one that gets embedded in the dialogue, the one that everybody talks about. Why talk about the 8 million people in the overnights if you can talk about 12 million if you just wait a few days? And network execs say, hey, yeah, DVRs, people are watching stuff on DVRs. We want to get paid more because people are not watching just overnight. So a few years ago, they got advertisers to say, yeah, okay, all right. If people watch your show within 3 days of its airing, it's called Live Plus 3, we will pay you for that total audience. Not just the overnights, not just the people who watch it live, but all the people who tape it on their DVR or any other way that they access it that we can control and pay attention to. Yes, we'll pay you for it, even though we know some of them, if not all of them, are fast forwarding through the commercials.
But when let me ask you this, Michael, when you fast forward through the commercials, are you like also kind of rummaging around in the fridge, answering emails, looking at your phone? Where are your eyeballs when you're fast forwarding through commercials?
I am very good at getting through commercials very quickly. Boom. I am not watching the commercials. Sometimes you can't help but notice it because they design them now to be seen. Trust me, though, it's not really registering the same as if I watched the ad.
Well, of course, because the messaging isn't going across. But I can tell you at times who sponsored Mad Men. I know it was BMW. I know it was certain brands were sponsoring Mad Men because I could see their commercials week after week, even if it was in fast forward.
That's right. So every week, practically, the changes in how people watch television keep growing. More and more people are streaming. They're watching online. They're using DVRs and watching it 5, 6, 7, 8 days later.
To give you some sense as to how fast that's growing, 2008, 2009, that TV season, 83% of viewing was done live. 83%. Now, the DVR penetration is about 50% of television
that's
homes.
That's a different
in the,
figure. That's a different figure. How many people watch television live now?
55%. And they expect...
No. That's how many people have a DVR.
No, 55%. This season, live viewing is 55%.
For prime time on the major networks?
Yeah, across the board, 55%.
Of all television in prime time?
Yes.
No question that a lot more people are time shifting. And the networks a few years ago got advertisers to pay for more of that audience that they're reaching. And now they're saying, hey, we want live plus 7.
Which is
all those people are watching.
Which is called commercial 7 or C7.
All right.
They want to pay for C7.
People are watching. And a lot of people apparently don't skip over the commercials. My question is, can't they tell you exactly how many people are not skipping over the commercials? Why does there have to be a debate? Everybody says some people just let the show play through and they're seeing the ads. Other people like me always skip. And some other people, sometimes they remember, sometimes they forget.
The industry average, which is shocking, it's 40% actually watch the ads.
Why?
Because
Why?
You know what? They have it on in the background and they're answering emails.
Yeah,
and
they're doing what they used to do. And so they're watching television the way they used to, was where the commercial was a chance to take a break and leave the room, get a new drink, chat, do something. It's like, come on, you're wasting your time. Just get through the show.
Well, they just needed to record it because they weren't home to see it live. So they recorded it and then, you know,
Who the hell wants to watch television live? Well, I mean, that's just such a time killer. Unless it's something truly exciting that you want to see while it happens. And that doesn't include dramas and comedies. I just can't understand why you'd want to watch it live. Even if I'm home at 8 o'clock, I don't start watching something until 8:15 or 8:20.
Right.
You know, I'm just not going to. I'm not going to sit there and watch an ad. It drives me nuts.
Unless you're live tweeting it. And if you are live tweeting it, why?
But they have such trouble telling how big their audience is. They can't give us good numbers on the streaming and online and all that stuff. It's a little hard. It's a little easier to tell on DVR usage, but can't cable companies and networks work together and say, yeah, you know what? Boom. This show this time, this is how many people watched on DVR and this is how many fast forwarded. Can't they register that?
Well, there's an old saying about advertising that 50% of your ad dollars are wasted. The unfortunate part is you don't know which 50%. And media outlets, in this case, basically these networks, they don't mind the fact that advertisers don't know which 50% because it kind of obscures whether what they're selling, their ad time, is actually working or not.
Well, I'm going to guess that NCIS and an older skewing show probably has more of their ads displayed than a younger show. With younger viewers.
Right. Well, you know, actually DVR adoption is beginning to slow and it's going to probably be, you know, 55-60% soon, but young adults.
So you're saying like 90% of homes have televisions and cable penetration as well. I mean, cable penetration is like 90%, right?
Something to that effect.
Right. And half of them are not getting DVRs?
Yes, correct.
Why then God's name would you have cable and not use a DVR?
Because you might be in a bar or you might be, you know, it's not necessarily a home.
In a home. All right. Yeah. Well, good God. I mean, well, I'd like to know figures for people who are in their own home watching television. If you're paying for cable, why you wouldn't have a DVR is beyond me. I mean, it's like not having a remote. It decreases the efficiency and use of your television astronomically. I mean, you know, your television is so much more enjoyable if you actually use a DVR or use your remote. Having to get up and change the channel is not a lot of fun, especially when there are 700 channels.
That's true. In fact, that's one of the this article points out that in 2014, 352 original scripted series during prime time. Now, keep in mind, that's a 56% jump over the last 5 years in the amount of content, amount of programming being produced.
And so about five years ago, about maybe 175 shows, original scripted, it's not reality, but scripted dramas and comedies were shown in prime time on all of television, meaning the networks and the cable outlets and FX and everything. And now that's that. No, I'm sorry. 56% jump means it was about 220 and now it's up to 350. That's right. A huge jump. An extra 120 shows, and that doesn't include reality.
Right, and there's somebody at FX, the network, that keeps a track of this.
That's the head of John Landgraf. He's the head of FX.
Yeah, and he said that there are 1,700 shows airing in primetime in some form or fashion. 1,700. Right.
And that's everything. That's reality, that's sitcom, drama, talk shows, you name it.
Now,
wow.
You're the ad guy, okay, who has to buy all that time, and you have to pick between 1,700 shows. And now you're not only picking up between 1,700 shows, you're also weighing print, you're weighing digital, you're weighing radio, all of these different mediums. And if you're a television network who's trying to sell your ad time, you're competing. The competition is just skyrocketed.
Yeah. Well, here's my solution. You know, the network wants you to pay for C7. That means for everybody who watches television live, plus over the next 7 days on their DVR or whatever other source that the network gives them. I say fine, but in return, you've got to give me more transparency. Let's look at who's watching, the total numbers, how they're watching it, and better info on what commercials they are skipping.
Well, Nielsen definitely gives you them some of that, the advertisers, that is. They're not publishing that. In fact, you mentioned
I don't know why somebody won't publish it. Give us the info. I want to know the top 100 shows of the week. Well, and I don't care if it's Good Morning America or The Jimmy Fallon Show or American Horror Story or the new Battle Creek on CBS. I just want to see a list of the top shows of the week. I don't care when they air. I just want to know total viewers, who's watching it. Give me the numbers.
Well, I know at least one or two people that will not be counted in whatever viewing figure it is you just came up with. They're definitely, unfortunately, not going to be counted among the viewers.
You're trying to move into obituaries?
Well, I was trying, but...
Okay. Yes, they won't be watching television, but we'll be watching their work.
That's right. We have, unfortunately, costume and production designer Patricia Norris died at the age of 83. She was Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning costume designer. Her last production, I think, was 12 Years a Slave, right?
That's right. You know, the last film that she has a credit on won Best Picture. That's a pretty good way to go out on top.
Yeah, and she won the Emmy for Twin Peaks.
That's right, for the pilot episode of Twin Peaks. She deserved to win just for Audrey's sweaters alone, trust me.
And she did Scarface with Al Pacino, not the original Scarface.
She was Oscar nominated 6 times, including Victor Victoria, The Elephant Man, Days of Heaven. She worked on The Waltons. That was one of her first jobs. She's the only person to win a Lifetime Achievement Award from both the costumers and the production designer. So that's pretty cool.
That's wild, actually, because, you know, production design has very little to do with costume design in most instances.
Well, I would think they'd all work together.
But as far as... You know,
it's all about the period and the thing, yeah, and reflect character. So to me, it makes sense. Right on Broadway right now, we have Bob Crowley. He did the sets and costumes for The Audience, starring Helen Mirren. And to me, it's just sort of logical. I mean, people don't always have the skill sets to do both. But to me, that whole look of the show, I mean, the clothing is inseparable from the time and the place and where they're sitting in the room and all that. But that's goodbye to Patricia Norris. But the other person who died is a documentary filmmaker, and they're actually pretty close to your heart, aren't they, Sperling?
Yes, Albert Mizell, who was part of the filmmaking team of David and Albert Mizell, they pioneered direct cinema. And
what does direct cinema mean, by the way?
You know, it started out as cinema verite in the 60s, in the late 50s and 60s, where the cameras got smaller, so 16mm film was a little bit more achievable, and synchronous sound, so sync sound. You could actually record the sound happening along with the image in a much more compact, mobile way. This actually helped there was a whole Italian movement as well in narrative film that had the same effect in Italian film, but along with David Mizell, Albert Mizell directed these films like Salesman, I believe was one of his, Gimme Shelter, about the Rolling Stones, and of course, Grey Gardens, which is a classic movie. But he directed dozens of films. This guy was working up until, I want to say, last year, this year. I mean, I think one of his films was in the New York Film Festival. And I've met him a couple times. I did my college thesis in cinema studies, was on Direct Cinema, and filmmakers like the Mizell brothers or like D.A. Pennebaker, who did Don't Look Back, and he did The War Room in the 90s on Bill Clinton's presidential campaign, and Richard Leacock. These are all kind of, there's no talking heads in these documentaries. They basically just follow somebody around, and whatever happens, happens. They don't interfere with it.
But like, yeah, it's sort of like the fly on the wall approach to filmmaking.
Right.
As far as, that's the difference between Direct Cinema as they saw it and Cinema Verite. Cinema Verite could call attention to itself.
Right.
Whereas Direct Cinema was not supposed to at all.
Right.
You weren't supposed to think that they were there. You're just watching things happen, which is to a little degree, as far as the key sections of Citizen Four, that's what that is like for me. The film does sculpt things and have voiceovers and stuff, but it does also include sections that are very much Direct Cinema, where you're just there watching things happen. And so when you interviewed him, what was he like?
Well, I didn't interview him. I mean, it was just, you know, meeting and passing at film festivals and at different events. And he was always very nice. Always,
I sure hope so.
Yeah, and very always upbeat. Always upbeat.
What's your favorite film by them?
Ooh,
which one have you watched more often?
Probably Gimme Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, and Grey Gardens. Those are just kind of classics, right? I mean,
absolutely.
So but there were certainly when doing doing my thesis, I would say Salesman was also up there, and When We Were Kings, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if they directed produced it.
No, they did not direct it, but he has shot some of the footage.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many movies that it's hard to keep track, frankly.
And he did a technical breakthrough, didn't he, as far as what you were talking about, sound recording. And he developed a way that the sound recording could be separate from the visuals, so that you could film without worrying about synchronization. You know, before you had to always worry about that, right? And that liberated the camera, didn't it? It let them stay over here in the corner, move around, do things without having to worry about picking up sound.
Right, and without actually the big recording equipment that you just couldn't schlep it places. So you could never kind of follow Bob Dylan around on tour, because you'd need to do it with a mixing board. That just wasn't feasible.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kind of all coalesced by the late 60s in Woodstock, and Monterey Pop is a big one, because you have Pennebaker and Leacock and Martin Scorsese, I think, at Woodstock.
Yeah.
So that Monterey Pop is and is probably one of the bigger films that all of these filmmakers wound up showing up at, and they all shot footage for this.
Say his name again, because I've always mispronounced it.
I've always known it as Albert Mizell, but now people are saying
I'm sure Mizells. You're right.
So I'm like, really? That's okay, I guess.
Yeah, the Monterey Pop was directed by D.A. Pennebaker, but of course they had lots of cinematographers on that, including Richard Leacock and Albert and Roger Murphy and Nick Dube.
Yes.
All right.
And they all kind of went off. I mean, it was a close-knit group, to say the least. Kind of like us, Michael. We're kind of close-knit.
That's right. And our viewers are like family, and we wish they would call and write more often.
And if they're watching me right now, our viewers, then they'd know I'm doing the show in my underwear.
Oh, good Lord.
Is that too much information?
I'm picturing Michael Keaton now in Birdman.
Ah, yes, but I'm much more...
You're not levitating.
No, I'm not levitating, and I can't throw chairs across the room with my mind.
If they want to tell you to put your clothes on, how should they reach us?
Oh, thank you for kind of pushing me along. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I should mention, if you have called during the past week, we keep getting one prank call, not a prank call, but telemarketing call after another, literally hundreds of them for some reason, all of a sudden over the past week. So it will be very difficult to find your voicemail in all of that clutter. But please do call and leave us a voicemail. You can also subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. That's usually where you can find us on those mobile app, those podcast mobile apps on your phone. Please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us, contact us, follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is at showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it changes. This week, Michael, what is it?
LeaveTheOscarsAlone.com.
You know, I don't even know how to follow that one up, other than to say that if you have trouble finding Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there and some of his coverage there, why not try MichaelGiltz.com, head on over to the Huffington Post, or even BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.